all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. Our guest today is Amy Shively Hawk. She's written a particularly poignant and personal story about her father, who was a captive in Vietnam. He was a pilot with the United States Air Force and was shot down over Vietnam. Amy, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Why don't you go ahead and start telling us about your father, his early years before he got to the U.S. Air Force Academy.
Sure. Well, he grew up in Spokane, Washington, beautiful little city over here on the West Coast in the Northwest, and just had a kind of a typical middle-class childhood, two parents and a sister. He grew up just basically obsessed with baseball and riding his bike. And then in high school, he very much excelled there. His parents were really keen on him getting a good education and a free education. So they basically required that he apply to the United States Air Force Academy. It wasn't really something that he wanted to do or had a passion for, but of course he did apply and he got in. And then that really set the course of his life from there.
It's an interesting story because oftentimes we hear of somebody who went to the academy who it was their lifelong dream to go do that or lifelong dream to go be a pilot. But here, really, Jim Shively went there for the education and found it was a difficult place for him originally to adjust to, but adjust he did, didn't he?
He sure did, and he really excelled there. He was an excellent student, got very good grades, and it was an expected course of action that their highest students would go on to pilot training. So he did and found that he just absolutely loved to fly. It turned out to be really the passion of his life. He went to pilot training in Arizona and then on to Nevada to Nellis Air Force Base for his combat training and just loved it. He was a risk taker, but he was smart. He loved to be in the air. He loved the exhilaration of it, and he was an excellent fighter pilot.
And Amy, one of the things that you've mentioned is that he was a pretty smart guy, demonstrated in high school how competent he was, but also at the academy. The Air Force sent him on to Georgetown University, where he picked up his master's degree in international relations before he went off to fly in Vietnam. That shows you're a pretty smart cookie, and he, your father certainly was.
He really was, and that degree ended up serving him later in life, too.
So we'll get back to that a little bit. That's why I wanted to make sure we mentioned it up front, because it'll tie in a couple of places where you go, well, this guy's smarter than your average bear. But tell us about what experiences a young pilot in that period of 68, 66, 67 would have been having in Vietnam, how many missions they had to fly and those sorts of things.
Sure. Well, he was sent over in 1966. He was 24 years old, and he was sent over to Southeast Asia to fly 100 missions over North Vietnam. That was his assignment. On his 69th mission, a surface-to-air missile was shot into the back of his plane, and it exploded the back off, and he had to eject out of the plane. He was injured upon ejection and landed in a rice paddy north of Hanoi.
So he's, folks, he's 24 years old or so when this happens. And as the title of Amy Shively Hawk's book indicates, 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton, he now spends the next 6 years as a Vietnam prisoner of war. Amy, tell us a little bit about your dad's early years adjusting to, that difficult situation.
Well, it was obviously extremely difficult. He had never expected or anticipated to be shot down. You know, as I mentioned, he was the best of the best when it came to fighter pilots over there. It was a very dark time for him. They captured him almost immediately, stripped and beat him, paraded him through the streets, and then threw him into what the prisoners came to call the Hanoi Hilton, which was really a dungeon-like holding cell internment camp. He was thrown into solitary, tortured and beaten and starved. He had infections that were left untreated. So he really was near death in those first, I would say, about 6 months. It's a miracle that he made it through.
And the physical deprivation was as challenging as the mental or emotional. As I read your book, I really get a sense of both things occurring to him. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, he talks about, I took this story based on tapes that he left before he passed away. Because when I listened to the tapes, it brought me into what he really went through. He had never talked much about his experiences when I was growing up in his home. And I think that's very typical of a lot of our veterans. So that's why I wanted to write this book and to bring out the fact that it wasn't even just the physical debasement, but the mental torture that our veterans were put through as well. He was really just dehumanized, forced to bow. At any moment, he could have his life taken from him. The interrogations were brutal. And then, of course, they would plant, seeds in their minds like, America doesn't care about you. It was a lot of psychological warfare as well that he had to work through. So I know that in those first few months, he actually wished that he hadn't ejected out, that it would have just been better if he would have gone down with his plane.
Amy, back up a little bit and tell our readers about the source material here. You were fortunate enough to have your dad's own recollections recorded. Tell us how that happened and how you used that information.
Well, it really was fortunate because, he didn't talk about it. Of course, when I was growing up, and he's my stepdad, he married my mom when I was 5 years old. He just didn't really talk about it. We knew, of course, that he was a war hero. He was a fighter pilot. We knew he had been a prisoner. But the real details of his captivity, he kept mainly to himself. And it wasn't until after he died that I discovered that he had made some recordings with a reporter up in Spokane who had hounded him for years to get his life story on tape, because this reporter was just fascinated and just felt that this was a story that needed to be told and needed to be preserved. And so when my dad found out that he had cancer and he got that diagnosis, it occurred to him that this was going to be his last opportunity to get his story out. So I think it was just easier for him to sit with the reporter than with, any of his family. And after he passed away, the reporter gave me the tapes, and I listened to them and just sobbed my way through them because, of course, I loved my dad, and it was very difficult to listen. But as I listened, I just knew that his story needed to make its way out there, not just to honor him, but to honor all of our POWs and veterans that served.
Well, I think that's an important point that your book does pretty well, which is it wasn't just Jim Shively who was a prisoner of war. You talk about many of the other men that he was captive with. Tell us a little bit about those guys and the information you got from some of them to help round out the story.
Sure. Well, I was able to interview John McCain, who, of course, is our nation's probably most prominent Vietnam prisoner of war. He was a friend to my dad. They were in the camp together at the same time, and I was able to interview him, get some of his own personal stories, and then he wrote the foreword for the book, which was very gracious of him. But I found out a lot from the men. I found out probably the main thing that I didn't realize before was that it was really each other that kept them going, because they had to be strong for the next guy. If they were in solitary, it was very difficult because they weren't having any communication and they had no one to rely on. But when they were put in the camps with other men in the cells, they felt that they needed to be strong for each other. And so that was one thing that really came out in the book, was that if it hadn't been for each other, it would have been much more severe.
And I think, listeners, this is why you really want to read the book. One of the reasons is the story about how the men, sometimes cellmates, sometimes they're in isolation and they're doing the tap code through the wall, but how they got each other through the mental hardship and the illnesses. I mean, a lot of illnesses just from their lack of food and medical attention. You do a great job of describing how they took care of each other in that regards. Amy, do you want to tell one of those stories?
Sure. There's one story that comes to mind. When my dad came out of solitary, they threw him in a cell with a couple of other guys, and it was a lucky break for him because one of the guys he had known in flight training school, so they were able to reconnect. But what ended up happening is that he ended up getting hepatitis, and he had raging infections because he was injured upon ejection, and so he had really deep cuts in his arms that were left untreated and got infected. So this infection was in his system. He had dysentery. He was vomiting all the time. And when I interviewed his cellmate told me, he said, "Amy, I don't know if your dad even knows this, but we kept him alive. We force-fed him the pumpkin soup stuff that they gave. So if it wouldn't have been for these men, he wouldn't have even survived. They made him eat and kind of nursed him back to health."
And even some of the medical care they had to do for themselves. You've got a story about your dad having a raging ear infection, and the only treatment, if you will, was to take the hot light bulb out of the ceiling to warm up a cloth so you'd have something hot to put on that infection and hopefully try to drain the pus. How did they, oh my goodness. I don't know. Did he talk about that in his recordings, or did you hear that from his fellow prisoners?
He actually did mention that one. This ear infection went on and on and on forever because, of course, they didn't give any medicine out. And they were forced to, if you could call it bathing, I think it was only once a week in this particular camp that they were able to get cleansed at all. And then the water was dirty. So it just wasn't healing up. And he would take a washcloth and get it hot on the light bulb and then just press it to his ear just to try to help with the pain. But then he would also have his cellmate push on the back of his ear, push everything forward so that the pus and everything could come out.
Again, I don't think many of us can fully appreciate the deprivation that these men went through and how they survived. Let's talk about some of the things that they did as a group to help them get through surviving. You write about Hanoi University. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, that was something that came up in the later years. It was about 71, I believe, after Ho Chi Minh died, that the men were all brought together into the same camp. And the result of that was that they were able to group together in larger numbers, which was really a blessing because they could take good care of each other, but also they started a Hanoi University because you have to realize just how boredom was the other mental anguish. You know, they weren't allowed to have books or cards or anything that might exercise their brains at all. So they started teaching classes. They would assign one prisoner to teach whatever he knew a lot about, and then they would just take turns teaching each other. But they ended up making it very structured, so you would have courses and classes and tests, and it turned out to be a real blessing for them, just as a way to exercise their minds.
And again, I think there's a little bit of that creative human spirit where when you're working together, you talk about how a couple of the prisoners were native Spanish speakers, so they were teaching Spanish to others, or your dad was teaching Russian. He had had advanced degrees, as we mentioned earlier, from Georgetown in International Affairs and taught some of that. I have to imagine that really elevated everybody's spirits, thinking about we might get through this, although we never know when we'll be released. Can you talk a little bit about how that not knowing when impacted the men?
Well, it was really a roller coaster. There were so many kind of up and downs because they would have air raids. The United States would have air raids. So the men would sometimes see the American B-52 bombers, you know, coming up over Hanoi, and it would give them, you know, a great sense of, okay, this war is about to end. America's coming back for us. Well, those would come and then they would go and there wouldn't be any change or the treatment would get even worse. So it started becoming just extremely nerve-wracking because it got to the point where they just felt like they couldn't hope anymore. I mean, how many years of torture and starvation have to go by before you just start to completely lose hope? And that was the other reason that they really had to depend on each other, because you know, even if a majority of them were downcast and in despair, thinking that they were never going to get out, never going to get their lives back or die in the camp, you know, there would usually be one that was saying, no, come on guys, we're gonna make it out. And it just takes that one person to lift up their spirits and give them that resilience. And you know, that is really what the book is about, and it's really the message of my dad's life, is keep holding on to hope and persevere and don't let go. Because what I realized when I was writing this book is that his situation was extremely brutal. And most of us will not ever have to face anything like that. But we will all have dark seasons. And I found myself even just clinging on to this endurance that I was kind of getting contagiously through my dad, because it really made me think, okay, if I'm going to be strong like Jim Shively, I'm going to persevere through this situation or this diagnosis or this relationship issue, whatever it is. So this book is really for anybody that needs an encouragement to just keep hanging on, and you will triumph on the other side.
I absolutely agree with you, Amy Shively Hawk, author of 6 Years in the Hanoi Hilton. this book's about hope. As I read what you wrote about whether it be the church services that they held or the singing of the national anthem to raise their spirits, or the American flag sort of made out of a tattered handkerchief by Mike Christensen, a naval pilot. These are stories you tell that give you hope. Let's go to the time after your dad gets released from the prison camps, returns home, decides that he doesn't want to stay in the Air Force as his career, and turns to settling down with the family and pursuing a new career. Tell us a little bit about how he took those experiences forward for the rest of his life, because while he was in a prisoner of war for a long period of time, you know, he had decades now to live as a free man. Tell us how it impacted him.
Well, it really did. For one thing, there's kind of a sweet love story in the book, kind of very subtly, but he and my mom had dated in high school, and they dated while my dad was at the United States Air Force Academy. But when he was sent over to Vietnam and shot down, you know, my mom didn't know if he would ever come back, or how long he would be over there, if he would die. And as the years went by, she finally realized that she needed to move on with her life. So she met and married my biological father and had me and my little sister. But when Jim came home, when the war ended and he was released from prison, she ended up divorcing my biological father and moving back to Spokane to marry Jim. And it's just kind of just another element within the story of, you know, he thought that he had lost the love of his life, but really they were always meant to be together. And they got married right away. He adopted my sister and I and raised us in his home. And then they went on to have two more daughters. And it was kind of funny that they had four girls, because one of the things that he had said, you know, he only ever laid eyes on men for 6 years. They never even saw a female. And he had said to his cellmate at one point, "When I get out of this camp, I want to live in a house full of women."
He got his wish in that regard. He went on to become a practicing lawyer and ultimately an assistant U.S. attorney, I believe, in Washington State. Tell us a little bit about that and his opportunity to use his education to give back to veterans.
Yes. He decided that he was going to not stay in the military. I think having my mom back in his life and then, you know, having two ready-made daughters, you know, and having more kids, they had more kids right away. He just kind of decided he wanted to stay put. Family became very special and important to him. He didn't want to travel. And he went and got his law degree, which he turned out to be exceptional at. He had already had his master's in international relations. And he became a very well-known attorney for the United States government. Before he worked for the United States government, though, he took on a case, Jim, that became widely known, and it was for a Vietnam veteran. And he took the case when nobody else would, because the veteran was clearly guilty and had committed a felony. And my dad looked through all his files and met with him and said, "I'm going to take this case." And it turned out to be a case that really turned out to advocate for veterans that needed mental health care that they weren't getting from our government. And so he was one of the men, at the forefront of standing up and saying, okay, we need to take care of these guys. Before post-traumatic stress disorder was even a term, he was at the forefront of advocating for mental health awareness for veterans.
This is, listeners, this is a story of a real American hero, and that term can be overused, but when you read this book by Amy Shively Hawk at 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton. You'll find out that Jim Shively was from his entire body of work, from what he did in the service to his completion of helping veterans. This is a guy that we're all really proud of. Amy, I want to thank you for writing this. How can people find out more about what you're doing and find the book and that sort of stuff? Give us a website or two that they can follow you on.
Sure. I'm at amyhawk.com. The book is 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton, and the foreword is by John McCain. It's available on Amazon.com and at Barnes & Noble and in bookstores near you. And I wanted to mention that I am partnering with the Headstrong organization, which they provide free mental health care to veterans that have post-traumatic stress disorder. It's an organization that I found that is run by veterans, so they understand, and it's a program that works. So I'm donating part of the proceeds from this book towards their organization because I know my dad would like that. He would want this to be about promoting health care and awareness for veterans.
Well, I'm sure he's proud of you up there, and we're certainly proud of him. We really enjoyed the book. I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Details after this.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position, but then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50 caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm you can reach at 800-693-4800. And we're really pleased today to have a couple of guests on Veterans Radio to talk about a veterans entrepreneurship program that the state of Florida is spearheading. We have with us Dr. Sandra Calanui, who's the Director of Institute for Entrepreneurship at Florida Gulf Coast University. Dr. Sandra, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
And we also have a veteran who has gone through the program, a Marine, served 8 years, James Hardenbrook. James, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we're glad to have veterans like you. You served in the Marines for 8 years, and you've now been with the VA in Cape Coral, I believe Florida, as a sort of a logistics manager since 2012. And this program is giving you an opportunity to branch into a new area. I think something many of us think about doing, and that is starting our own business. But Dr. Sandra, why don't you tell us a little bit about this Veterans Florida Entrepreneurship Program?
Thank you. The program is designed to help veterans start businesses. So we have, there are seven different places across the state at universities, seven different universities that have developed, that have this program. And the way it works is that the veterans come in every other week this year. Last year we did a little bit differently. We're pivoting and changing as we go to see what are some of the best practices. But they come in to the university for a full day every other week, and we have a half a day of instruction and explain to them, you know, different parts of how to start the business. And then in the afternoon, we bring in mentors from the community that have been entrepreneurs and been successful entrepreneurs who volunteer their time to work with the individual veteran to help them with their particular plan and their what they want to do. And we do that over this year it's over a 15-week period, the every other Saturday. On the alternating week that they're not in the classroom or working on their business in the university, we do an online work with them, we communicate with them, they send us information, we have an online program as well. And for us, we've made our university open to our veterans, so we have an incubator, and they will come out here, and 2 days a week we open it for them to come. They can come anytime they want, but 2 days a week we are available one-on-one to meet with them and help them during the week. Because once they get started, they need help going through the process and making all of the pivots and changes they need to make as they test different ways of starting their business.
Now, Dr. Sandra, did this idea start at Florida Gulf Coast University, or did it start at the state of Florida's Department of Veterans Affairs? Where did it start?
It was a grant that was provided by through the Congress for the state of Florida to attract veterans to Florida and to keep our veterans here. So the grant was provided to veteransflorida.org, which is an organization that supports veterans. Both part of the funding they get is to help them with jobs, and the other part is to start entrepreneurship and startup entrepreneurial business. And they put out bids for grants, and the first year five universities received the funding for this in the state. And then it turned out that the way it worked, we ended up, they came back to us and asked, Veterans Florida asked us to help to develop the curriculum for the program, because this was brand new and we had been teaching entrepreneurship in the classroom. So we helped to develop it and train the other universities last year, and then this year it's grown to seven universities now, and we're all using the exact same program. So what's nice about that is if it's Saturday and it's a Veterans Day, everyone is teaching basically the same material, and they're doing the same mentoring in the afternoon.
Could you give some examples of what the curriculum consists of, Dr. Sandra?
Yes, it's based on the Lean Startup, and what that is how do you come up with a problem that needs to be solved in which people are willing to pay you for. So something that's you know, a problem or a service, it could be a product or service that people are willing to pay you for, and how do you do it by developing a minimum viable product, so develop something that's minimum viable product that you can economically get in, start your business. once you start it and it can grow, then you can start to do more and more services and more things. But to begin with, you know, let's not go bankrupt before you make sure that it's actually a viable product. So if you do it inexpensively, what that does is allows you to test the product, test the demand, and make sure that it's viable before you go spend a whole lot of your life savings on it. So we teach that. The lean startup method is what we teach in the classrooms as well, but it's in the last 4 or 5 years, it has become a major change in the entrepreneurial world and how people are starting businesses. So rather than going out and trying to raise $1 million and then it doesn't work, you know, let's test it with a small amount of capital and see if we can't get it on its feet.
Well, I think the listeners of Veterans Radio just got their pearl of wisdom for the podcast, because there's none other than that right there, because so many times I hear people come in with these grandiose plans. You really got to focus on, as you say, that minimal problem to be solved that can be started up and test the theory and see if it works. Who's the faculty for these sorts of things?
Yeah, we use at our faculty, I'm the chair of the entrepreneurship program here at FGCU. We have other entrepreneurship faculty, and we also use instructors that teach in entrepreneurship. So we use our entrepreneurship faculty, and then we use mentors who have been successful entrepreneurs. So we use a combination of those to do the program. And we happen to have at FGCU, we were lucky enough to get some donor money, which some of the schools have and some haven't. That's really an individual thing. And so we're able to help at the end by having a compassionate Shark Tank. And so the veterans were able to pitch for it. In addition, we had some other funding from another veteran that had specific requirements as far as years of service. And we were able to get some of these veterans seed funding so they didn't have to go out and borrow money to start their business.
Well, let me bring in James Hardenbrook.
Yes.
Who's a Marine, has a full-time job, it looks like, and for many, that probably keeps him more than busy enough, probably a family as well. And somewhere along the line, James, you said, I want to get into business of my own. After your family said you're nuts, tell us how you got attracted to this program.
Basically, I have to credit it to my wife. I was actually sitting there one day at the house, and she came in and she said, hey, I'm pretty sure you'd be interested in taking this program. I said, all right, well, what is it? So she kind of read off some things, and I said, yeah, that sounds like something I might be interested in devoting some time to. Well, long story short, over a year later, I'm still working with them, and we found a business model that I like. One thing that I like to do is take a look at other businesses, how they operate, kind of apply the Lean Six Sigma process to it and see how I could possibly make it better. I had her sign me up for the course. I went ahead, I attended the course. We started looking at possibilities of different things that we could do. And my wife, staying home, taking care of our daughter, she started, you know, talking about wanting to gain maybe some part-time employment. So what we came up with was we could do a food concession trailer. After we learned that brick-and-mortar store cost way more than what we could actually afford, going through the course, we figured out that the minimum viable.
So, James, you're breaking up a little bit. I'm going to have you get to some place where we can get some better clarity on the phone call. But Dr. Sandra, in the curriculum that you teach, is there like a segment on business plans or marketing or finance?
Yes,
what do you walk through?
Yeah, we first start out with having them put together a business model canvas, which is basically, okay, what's the problem, what's the solution, who's your target market, how are you going to take the market, and it's in a map sort of form, so that before you try to write a full business plan, you kind of map it out, and then how are you going to test that it works? So how do you go talk to people, get outside the building, talk to people, and confirm that it works? So in James's case, he found out that, you know, really people, that there was a big diversity of where people were that wanted his product, and maybe, you know, putting it in a brick and mortar store, not only expensive, but probably wasn't the best way to get to his marketplace. So those going out and testing it, we do that, and we go through each of the subsections as far as what that means. You know, what does it mean for how do you put together your marketing plan? How do you put together your pricing model and things like that? Once they've done that, then they start to develop a plan to launch their business. Very differently than we talk about a business plan that tries to project out 5 years and what wonderful things you're going to do. Let's talk about launching it and how long is it going to take to break even. Because you need to have enough capital so that you can launch it and you can break even. And you know, once you start to make money, it's a lot easier to run your business. But you have to get to that point first. So that's the process. They come out with a full plan to launch and get their business going as part of the process of the program.
James,
so they literally have the whole thing done when they leave at the end of 6, 8 weeks, 14 weeks of the program. So,
James, I wanted to bring you back in and ask you how scary it was to walk into this program on a college campus when that really wasn't your background, and walking into this the first time, kind of what would you tell other veterans who may have a little bit of fear or trepidation?
I would say that I'm not a educational speaking type individual, but walking into the program, the instructors and the other veterans who attended the class, it was kind of you start to build that camaraderie that veterans in general have, where everybody is more than willing to go above and beyond whatever it is that you need, if you need any help at all. The biggest thing is, I guess most people would have a issue with saying, I need help with something, because everybody thinks that, you know, they can do everything themselves. That's not the case. I found that if I have an issue with something, I can, you know, ask somebody else to kind of take it on and help me with it. And then they come back with multiple different scenarios or different avenues of approach that I didn't think of myself. And it actually becomes a lot more conducive to the learning environment when, you know, there's a lot of people that are willing to help you.
James, do you think this was something that you were willing to sort of overcome that initial reluctance on because it was veteran focused as compared to just a business startup program somewhere else or with a whole bunch of different folks?
I do. I firmly believe that because it was a veterans program, if it was anything other than a classroom full of veterans, I more than likely would not have been interested in it. Just because I wouldn't have had the things in common with the other students that were attending the class as well.
And Dr. Sandra, as you've approached this, you know, you've got a PhD, you've got an MBA.
Right.
Most
right.
of the folks in this class, I suspect, don't have college degrees, maybe
right.
no college, no even community college sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach subject matter differently because you're working with this particular type of cohort?
I try and be very basic, but I also have lots of people with them helping them. So, you know, a lot of them, you know, might struggle with the technology, or because we have software that we use for it. So we have We have our students sitting next to them. We have our volunteers sitting there and helping them. You know, we understand that it's scary, but, you know, I also let them know I started the business before I had a college degree. I started my business when I was 22 years old. I did not have a degree when I went to, I did not have a lot of college under my belt at that point. So I try to teach it in the same way that I know they will understand it. I try to, you know, get to the basics of what needs to be done. And truthfully, I think some of our veterans, just like anybody else, struggles with technology as well as I do sometimes, but we have enough help around to do the things that they're not comfortable with to help them. So, and I think it's about that. There are no tests. There's no, you know, there's not a stupid question. Everything has a meaning and needs to be asked. And so, you know, we're there to help them. And I just, because everybody who works in this program at our university cares so deeply about the contribution veterans has made to our country, they're very proud to be there and very willing to do it. And nobody's doing it because they have to. They do it because they want to.
I understand this is a no-cost program.
Yes. It is no cost to the veterans. We get funding through a grant for enough to get us by. It's certainly not something that is, you know, if it were just for grant money, it's not what drives us. Everybody in that room is there because they want to, including 20 to 30 mentors that come every single Saturday and spend their afternoons doing nothing but sitting there helping them.
Let me ask, and before I turn to James, I want to talk about the business he's working on. Can I hear from you, Dr. Sander, whether or not this kind of program is at other universities or other states are implementing this sort of thing?
Yeah, there are other states that are implementing things that are a little bit different, and some of them they can get, they can travel across to a different state to get to it. So I would encourage anything you can find to get this from your university, from a university. We particularly favor our own just because they have we have enough time to let the veterans start and grow and work on their business over a period of time. And because they're community based, all of our schools within the state are community based so that veterans can come back and forth and get help, which makes a difference. But there are others. As Syracuse has one out of the that's where it's housed at. But they're in other states. So I would certainly say that if you're not in the state of Florida, that you should look at veterans entrepreneurship programs. Recommend not doing it totally online. Do it something where you actually get to people you can get help from.
Hey, James, tell us a little bit about the business you're planning out.
So the business that we're planning on is actually named The Frozen Chosen. What we're going to do is we're customizing individual portioned ice creams with the use of liquid nitrogen. It's going to be as simple as you're going to tell us what cup size you want. You're going to pick a base. That's going to start either chocolate or vanilla. You choose either what you want mixed in it or choose toppings. And basically, in under about a minute, we can have your ice cream made and you can consume it right then. With the use of liquid nitrogen, it actually creates a solid ice cream with much smaller ice crystals than what the traditional hand-scooped ice cream would be, which actually provides a higher quality product. We're also going to source only local fruits and produce. So we're going to get them from a local farm here in Lee County. Our base is coming from a local to Florida ice cream base manufacturer who's been in business almost 70 years. So we know that we're going to have a very consistent product. We're also going to follow along the military kind of theme and create standard operating procedures so that way every single portion of ice cream that's made will have a very consistent flavor and texture to it.
That sounds like a great idea. It's certainly down south where that will be well received in the warm weather. And you're going to do this out of a food truck? Is that the idea, or a trailer? What's going to be the setting for it?
So basically what we learned from the course was a brick-and-mortar store is going to carry way too much overhead than what we'd be able to operate at. So doing it out of a food concession trailer, we're going to be able to have the mobility to move to where our customers and our target market will be at. That will also allow us to strategize our specific target events that we plan on visiting. And then in the future, we'll also be able to open it up to catering for either birthdays or private events, weddings, things of that nature. And we'll be able to come to you rather than you be inconvenienced to come to our destination.
James, could you talk a little bit about the impact the mentors had on you during this program?
Absolutely. The mentors, I'll tell you one thing that the mentors did best for me is they kind of gave me a snapshot of basically the market or the idea that you plan to bring to the market does not care if it's a good idea or not. They're going to tell you what your product should look like and what it should do for them. No matter how good of an idea that you have, it's a good idea to you, but it might not be a good idea to anybody that is willing to spend money on. So they gave me I would give them an example, and they would come back with multiple different questions that I would then go back out, question my target market, and come back with. And the majority of the time, they were right, and it's just things that they've been exposed to in the past that somebody like me first starting out doesn't have the experience or the forethought to actually think of things like that. So that the mentors themselves have saved me so much money, and I haven't even launched yet.
Well, I think this is the sort of thing that we veterans can also appreciate. We all learn from our chiefs or our sergeants, if you will, and they've been there, done that, kid, I'm trying to save you some grief. And that's kind of what the mentors are doing, too, for you, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. And the mentors are everybody and anybody you could ever think of, from all different business backgrounds to just all walks of life. And if you can't find someone somewhere who's a mentor in there that you can connect with somewhere, then, the class has done a very, very good job of, Dr. Kawanui has done a great job of saying, I have an individual that you could probably speak with. And then she gets right back to us with, that point of contact or that individual that we should make contact with and set something up. And she's done that with me on multiple occasions, and they've turned out to be great individuals that I would have never met if I didn't take the course.
Dr. Kalanui, as we come to the end of our time available here, can you maybe give our listeners a website or a contact approach if they wanted to keep track of the program or assist in the program or learn more about it?
Yeah, well, I can give them a couple of different things. The Veterans Florida is veteransflorida.org, O-R-G. And they can go to that, and they should be able to then talk about the, I'm looking at it right now, it's got the entrepreneurship program on there. They can get that information from there. And certainly, we have, my name is hard to spell, so it's but the IFE.org is our website, and we've got information on there about the Veterans Florida. But the best place to the entrepreneurship program, the best place is to go to Veterans Florida Entrepreneurship Program website. The other is if they're not in Florida, they should just go on and search. Search veterans entrepreneurship, and they will find some programs. There are several amongst several states that they could find it in.
Well, I want to thank James Hardenbrook and Dr. Sandra Kalanui for talking to us today on Veterans Radio, and thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or at the web, legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.